All right, looks like we're up running. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's kind of a dreary Sunday here in Michigan. It's been really warm lately, so that's been a little bit odd, but it's coming probably, right? It's only a matter of time. You should have in front of you a set of notes for Lesson 104, The Life and Times of William Tyndale, 1494 to 1526. Okay? Last Sunday, so introduction, last Sunday in Lesson 103, we began looking at vernacular translations of the Textus Receptus by looking at Martin Luther's translation into German. And we saw that that started with the New Testament in September 1522, and it ended finally with the completion or publication of a full, complete Bible 12 years later in 1534. So we went over that stuff last time. This week we want to begin looking at William Tyndale and his groundbreaking translation into English. Over the next couple of lessons, we will be looking at the following points, okay? So we're going to spend some time looking first at the life and times of William Tyndale. That'll be this study and then the next study. And then I really want to spend some time looking at William the translator and what he did and why it is so significant in terms of the first printed translation of the Bible into English. And then how that set up a system of refinement that ultimately culminated in the English language with the King James Bible in 1611. So I kind of have a little bit of a grand plan. I want to make sure that we're covering things in a somewhat timely manner, but also sort of thorough. Okay. So with the introduction then, let's look at my first point today is from Wycliffe to Tyndale. So back last fall now, in September, October, around in there, we spent about three studies looking at John Wycliffe. What I want to do in this point is try to bridge that time gap in England between the work of John Wycliffe in the late 1300s with what Tyndale's going to do nearly 200 years later, okay? So from the time of John Wycliffe in the late 1300s to William Tyndale in the early 16th century, the Lollards remain a witness in England to the truth of Scripture and stood against the Roman Catholic Church despite persecution. So hopefully you're remembering what we went over about the Lollards, the followers of Wycliffe, and how they spread his teachings and copied his Bible and so forth despite the fact that they were being persecuted. Quote, from the times of Wycliffe, the great English reformer, the Lord preserved a remnant in England who witnessed for the truth and who testified against the doctrines and superstitions of Rome. We found many of the descendants of the Lollards or followers of Wycliffe in the western districts of Scotland who were prepared to receive the new doctrines of the continental divines, that would be the reformers, on the continent of Europe, okay? So it was in England. There were many, very many among the humbler classes who still held to the doctrines taught by their great chief, but they were compelled to hide themselves among the humbler ranks of people and hold their meetings in secret. So that's the Lollard movement, right? Those guys are officially enemies of the state, if you will, for possessing and reading and teaching from an English translation, albeit Middle English translation, and so they are continuing to exist. But they are having to carry out their beliefs in secret, lest they raise persecution against themselves by the organized church. E.H. Broadbent, author of The Pilgrim Church, concurs with Miller's assessment. Broadbent states, quote, the Lollard movement was outwardly suppressed, but there were always remains of it, and from time to time, persons who published for meeting together to read the scriptures. So there are these folks, they continue sort of in a latent succession, they're there, they're kind of behind the scenes, they're trying to stay out of the crosshairs of the organized church, and they're continuing to, you know, read these Middle English Bibles, teach from them, and so forth, all through that period from the late 1300s, so through the 1400s, and then into the early 1500s when we see Tyndale emerge. Miller offers as evidence for his claims of the burning of six men and women at Canterbury in 1519 for teaching their children the Lord's Prayer, the Ten Commandments, and the Apostles' Creed in the vernacular tongue. So again, you got persecution happening for people just daring to teach their children things from the scriptures in English instead of Latin. Okay? Church historian Kenneth Scott Lorette reports, Lollardry had never completely died out. It persisted chiefly among the poor and often in outward conformity with the church. Translations of the Bible existed in English and were read, although not by any means as widely as after the invention of printing. So again, that's just another point, corroborating what we've been saying about that. Okay? Now, Erasmus. Erasmus first came to England in 1497, a mere 3 years after the birth of Tyndall in 1494. Regarding Erasmus's first trip to England, Blackford Condon, author of the History of the English Bible, extending from the earliest Saxon translations to the present Anglo-American revision, states the following. The first visit of Erasmus to England was in 1497. He praises not only Groyken, that's some guy, I can't find out for sure who that is, Colette, Lineker, and More. So More there would have been Sir Thomas More, who later becomes a high-ranking official under King Henry VIII. Okay? He says he found in England a treasure of old books and the highest appreciation of learning. So Tyndall is born in, and we're going to see this in a minute, he's born in 1494. Erasmus comes to England in 1497. Okay? And as we'll see in a minute, Erasmus is going to teach for a fairly long period of time at the University of Oxford. Okay? So 1494, is it three or four? What did I say?
Four.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is Tyndall's born here, 1497. Erasmus comes to England, okay, for the first time. So that places the great Renaissance humanist in England 3 years after the birth of Tyndall, okay? Into soil tilled by Wycliffe and the Lollards were the seeds found in the writings of Erasmus and later Luther sown. Into this fallow ground, the writings of Luther would certainly find fruitage. They were, did I skip a point? No, I didn't skip one, did I?
No.
They were not long in reaching Oxford and Cambridge. In Cambridge especially, they awakened interest. Here was a circle whose members, aided by the Greek New Testament of Erasmus, was earnestly studying the scriptures. Lorette reports that Thomas Bildney and Hugh Latimer were Cambridge men who embraced the writings of Luther and who later were burnt at the stake as heretics. Okay? So you got a progression here. Tyndall's born in 1494. Erasmus shows up in England in 1497 for the first time. Okay? After being printed in Wetzel in 1516, Erasmus's Greek New Testament made its way to England, where it was embraced by some and condemned by others. Transported across the channel, it was received into England with enthusiasm and was offered for sale in the bookstalls of London, Oxford, and Cambridge. The first of the new learning were delighted, but the hierarchy was alarmed. The priest saw the danger, as Diabling says, quote, and by a successful maneuver, instead of finding fault with the Greek Testament, attacked the translation and the translator. They cried out, he has corrected the Vulgate and puts himself in the place of Saint Jerome. Look here, this book called upon men to repent instead of requiring them, as the Vulgate says, to do penance. Okay? So what's happening here is, as Erasmus's Greek New Testament is making its way now through England, they're finding fault with it. One of the things that they don't like about it is that in Greek he says that people need to repent, change their mind, not do penance, right? Well, in the Catholic system, is there a big difference between doing penance and repenting or changing your mind? There's a huge difference, right? And so they're finding fault with Erasmus's Greek New Testament because of that, what they perceive to be a significant change, okay? The Erasmine Greek and Latin New Testament was an important preparatory step towards the vernacular version of the New Testament. In the preface to Erasmus, Tolney stated, I differ exceedingly And differ exceedingly from those who object to the scriptures being translated into the vernacular tongues and read by the illiterate, as if Christ had taught so obscurely that no one could understand him but a few theologians. So this is what Erasmus is saying, okay? So Erasmus is objecting to the idea that the common people don't have the Bible in their own in their own language, okay? That no one can understand them but a few theologians, or as if the Christian religion depends upon being kept secret. And I wish that the scriptures might be translated into all languages, that the husbandman might repeat them at his plow, the weaver sing them at his loom, okay? So that's a statement that Erasmus makes. Erasmus wants the Bible to be available to the people in their own language, so that the husbandman can sing it at his plow and the weaver at her loom. William Tyndale utilized the work of Erasmus to produce something better, a printed edition of the Word of God in English. Quote, "But this Greek and Latin Testament was but a preparatory step to something better. It must needs be translated into the languages of the people. This was the desire of Erasmus, but the purpose of Tyndale. A purpose not to be fulfilled except through opposition, danger, exile, and final martyrdom. The story of Tyndale's life and this translation of the New Testament into English is one. There are successive steps in the life of John Wycliffe which both fitted and unfitted him for the work of translating the Bible. How long he meditated on the design, we do not know, but he did not execute it till the close of his eventual life. It was otherwise with William Tyndale. The purpose to translate the Holy Scriptures was the one purpose and the one work of his life. No name in the whole history of vernacular versions deserves such prominence as that of William Tyndale. Our common English Bible," they're referring there to the King James Bible of today, "is so largely indebted to Tyndale's translation that all who love their English Bible will unite in honoring the memory of William Tyndale, who suffered expiations and martyrdom for the sake of giving his countrymen the New Testament in their own language, okay, or in their own tongues." So Tyndale is a massively important figure, okay? He's a massively important figure in terms of just the history of the Reformation, number one, and the history of the English Bible, number two, but also, number three, as the rough draft for what would ultimately be the King James Bible, okay? So Tyndale is a central figure for our purposes for a variety of reasons, okay? So does anybody have any questions or comments about this first point, about from Wycliffe to Tyndale? No? Okay. So, we've sort of been building into this now for quite some time, right? We started with Wycliffe, we looked at his translations, we looked at how he was treated, then we went to Erasmus, we looked at the invention of the printing press, the New Testament being rendered into Greek. Last Sunday we looked at Luther and how Luther is the first one to take that Greek text of Erasmus and translate it into a vernacular language. And now what we're going to see, start looking at today, is how Tyndale is going to do the same thing for the English-speaking people, okay? So Life and Times of William Tyndale, 1494 to 1523. William Tyndale was born in 1494 to a prosperous yeoman family not far from Gloucestershire. David Daniel reports that the Tyndale family was a well-connected family of some prominence. He says, quote, "The Tyndales were well-connected. It is a neglected fact that William the Translator was more elevated in his family line than any of his adversaries in England, certainly than Tunstall, Wolsey, Stocksley, and more." So, was Tyndale of a higher birth status, if you will, than the people that are trying to kill him, basically, or shut him down, okay? So he leaves all that, the trappings of all that privilege behind him, so that he can go out and ultimately translate the Bible, okay? Recent work on the Tyndales of Gloucestershire and their close connection with the 4th century Tyndales of Northampton and Norfolk produced the following comment by a genealogist in the family, quote, that they heir been many profitable marriages by the Tyndalls is significant by the number of women espoused who were daughters and heirs of knights or their nieces. Okay, so in other words, was there some prestige in the family here as far as their status in society? Okay, before I go too much further into this, I want to share something with you. This is from a book simply called Old Bibles. This was written by a guy named J.R. Dorr. It was published in 1888. And there's a write-up in here about the Tyndall Bible. It says here on page 17, it says, Tyndall afterwards removed to the University of Cambridge, but the precise date at which he left Oxford is unknown. We'll get to all that in a minute. Here's the part I wanted. But most biographical notices of Tyndall are taken from John Fox's Acts and Monuments of the Martyrs, otherwise known as Fox's Book of what? Martyrs. But then it says, but no reliance can be placed on the truth of any uncorroborated statement made by Fox. So Fox has a lot of stuff that he says about Tyndall that we cannot know for sure if it's actually what? True. In fact, some of it is most definitely probably legend. Okay? In other words, we can't prove it to be the case from sources outside of Fox. Okay? So, William does not surface in the historical record until the age of 18 when he entered Oxford University. So we know when he was born. He was born in 1494. We know a little bit about the family as far as the work that's been done from a genealogy standpoint and a little bit about Tyndall's family. But then we don't really know anything about him that whole time period from the time he's born until he shows up at Oxford at the age of 18. So if you look at the quote at the bottom of page 3, the first record of him probably when he was 18, from which his likely year of birth is deduced, is the University of Oxford records, which show him as William. Mike, how would you say this name?
William Hitchens.
William Hitchens, a family name, taking a BA or a Bachelor of Arts as a member of Magdalen Hall on 4 July 1512. Okay. He was licensed with an MA, Master of Arts, on the 26th of June, 1515, and another MA, a second MA, on the 2nd of July, 1515, a degree which permitted him for the first time to read theology. So, he's got to get a BA, a Bachelor of Arts, and 2 master's degrees before they'll even let him read theology. Okay? At the time. That this official study did not include scriptures appalled him. So he goes through 1 bachelor's degree and 2 master's degrees and has never read any of the scriptures to get these degrees. Okay? Fox records that Tyndall read privily to certain students and fellows of Magdalen College some parcel of divinity, instructing them in the knowledge and truth of scriptures. Erasmus, whose Oxford home some years before had been Magdalen College, and who until recently had been Lady Margaret's professor of divinity at Cambridge, published in 1516 his Latin translation of the New Testament with the original Greek alongside. It is more likely that it was from this influential volume that Tyndall led those private studies. Fox states that Tyndall went to Cambridge, but no records support this. Okay? So let's look at this. So Erasmus comes for the first time in 1497, and then at some point here, it's not real clear, in 1512, let's make sure we get this down, in 1512, Tyndall shows up where? Tyndall's at Oxford. Whoops. Tyndall's at Oxford College. Okay. In 1515, he gets 2 MA degrees.
Master of Arts degrees. In 1516, this is when Erasmus publishes the Greek New Testament. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. Somewhere in this time period, Erasmus had been professor for about 6 years in Greek at either Oxford or Cambridge, right? Now, I don't think that the evidence does not suggest that Tyndale ever met Erasmus personally, but he is certainly influenced by Erasmus and by people who Erasmus influenced. Okay? Any questions about that before we move on? So after completing his studies at Oxford, Tyndale returned to Gloucestershire and took a job as a tutor. Tyndale went back to Gloucestershire at an unknown date. He became tutor to the children of Sir John and Lady Walsh at Little Soundbury Manor, a dozen miles south of the district of his birth. It is probable that he used his time to study and even begin, I think I should say begin, and even began or began, I can't have to look it up, to translate into English Erasmus's Greek New Testament. So after he leaves the university here, we know he went to Oxford. There are three entries about him in the records of Oxford University. John Fox says that he went to Cambridge, although there's no proof or evidence that he also ever went to Cambridge or studied there. We know that this is when Erasmus publishes his Greek New Testament. Somewhere after all of this, he takes this job as a tutor for this family, and we don't know the exact date. Okay? While there is no positive historical proof that Tyndale began his English translation while working in the Walsh household, there is substantial evidence that it was on his mind to do so. Quote, which thing only moved me to translate the New Testament, because I perceived by experience how that it was impossible to establish a lay people in any truth except the scriptures were plainly laid before their eyes in their mother tongue, that they might see the process, order, and meaning of the text. For else, whatsoever truth is taught them, these enemies of all truth quench it again. So in other words, what's Tyndale saying? I can teach people what I know it is, what I know the Bible is, but if they don't have it in their own language that they can read it, somebody's going to come along and do what? Say that everything I taught them is what? Wrong. Okay? While I am sowing in one place, the enemy ravaged the field that I have just left. Oh, if Christians possessed the Holy Scriptures in their own tongue, they could of themselves withstand these sophists. So Tyndale is understanding very early on here that the people need the Bible in their own what? In their own language, and that the only hope that they have against false teaching is to have the Bible in their own language. So he says, I plow this field, I leave to go over here, and as soon as I leave, then these sophists emerge over here, and they spoil everything that I just planted there, because the people don't have what? They don't have the scriptures in their own language or in their own tongue. Okay? Tradition reports that it was during his time in the Walsh household that Tyndale had the following famous encounter with a Catholic priest. Okay? The priest, Fox reports that the priest said, it would be better to be without God's law than the Pope's. To which Tyndale replied, I defy the Pope and all his laws. If God spares my life ere many years, I will cause a boy that driveth the plow shall know more of the scriptures than thou dost. Now, how many have heard that famous quote before? So a few of you might have heard it, right? It sounds a lot like Erasmus, doesn't it? What did we see a few pages earlier about Erasmus? Erasmus said that he wanted the people, the guy who's the husbandman driving the plow, to be able to recite the scriptures in his own what? In his own language, right? And now here's Tyndale saying this in this famous encounter with this papist here during this time period where he appears to be working as a tutor in the house of the Walshes. Okay? Run-ins such as this made it difficult for the Walsh family to retain Tyndale in their employ. You can understand why. People are starting to put pressure on the family and say, why do you have this heretic, this guy teaching your kids? And so they start to put pressure on the family to relieve him of his his responsibility. Joseph Bosworth, in the preface to the Gospels, Gothic, Anglo-Saxon, Wycliffe, and Tyndale versions, arranged in parallel columns, states the following about why Tyndall left Gloucestershire for London. He says, quote, at the top of page 5, at whose house Tyndall had many disputes on religious subjects with the clerical dignitaries of the neighborhood who frequented Sir John's table. This brought him into much danger that he deemed it prudent to leave the country and go to London. So because of the disputes that he's having about these issues, he eventually decides that he needs to leave and decides that he's going to go to London now. Okay? Is everybody with the story so far? Okay? Now, we need to understand why he makes this decision. Tyndall's move to London was a calculated one in an attempt to secure a patron who would support his desire to translate the Bible into English. Previously, Tunstall, the Bishop of London, had praised Erasmus for his great learning. I'm going to say something about that. I saw this spelled a bunch of different ways. Some sources spelled Tunstall like this, T-O-N, okay? And a bunch of them spelled it like this, T-U-N. More spelled it this way than that way, so I went with this one.
With one L or two L's?
I saw it
both ways.
But I'm going with two L's for the notes. Okay? Tyndall came to London hoping to find a patron in Bishop Tunstall. I guess I already kind of said that there. Since he remembered that Tunstall was highly extolled by Erasmus for his great learning, so long as the revival of learning confined itself to classical literature, Tunstall, like Sir Thomas More, was a friend of the movement. But since it was opening wide the door of Protestantism, he was no longer its friend. Consequently, in his house, there was no place for Tyndall. So understand, why does Tyndall go to London, specifically seeking Tunstall as a patron? The reason he did that is because previously had Erasmus praised this guy.
Right.
Yes. But the tide had changed by this point. Luther had posted his 95 theses. Things were different. And people that had been favorable toward Erasmus and were okay with Erasmus, as long as he was talking about Greek, now were not so okay with the idea of taking that Greek and putting it into what? English, specifically in this case. Okay? David Daniel concurs with Condon regarding the relationship between Tyndall and Bishop Tunstall. Quote, Tyndall already had the vocation to print the New Testament in English, and needing permission, hoped to be supported by Cuthbert Tunstall, Bishop of London. Tunstall had been highly praised by Erasmus, with whom he worked in the Low Countries on the second edition of his Greek New Testament, leading him to a Greek manuscript and consulting others. I think they should say others. Okay? He had been at Oxford with Colette, Linacre, and More, who singles him out for praise at the beginning of his Utopia. So when Sir Thomas More writes Utopia, he basically dedicates it to Erasmus. Okay? It was known throughout Europe as a mathematician and classicist. So that's Tunstall's reputation. That's why Tyndall went there. Tyndall, probably arriving in London in the spring of 1523, had a letter of introduction from Sir John Walsh to Sir Henry Guilford, Henry VIII's controller and master of the house, and he himself wrote to an old friend in Tunstall's service, William Helbiathwaite, that's how I'm saying it, all to no end. Tunstall replied as Tyndall wrote, his house was full. I understood at last that there was no room in my Lord of London's palace to translate the New Testament. Okay? So, Tyndall's not behaving rashly here, right? The reason he wants to go there is because Tunstall has a reputation in the past of having been favorable towards Erasmus. He comes with letters of introduction. He comes with the appropriate, you know, documentation for introduction into one's household that you would expect to have back in this time in history, and he's basically told what? No. All right? So this puts us now at roughly 1523. And this is when he goes to London. And he's trying to get patronage from who? Tunstall. Tunstall tells him what? Tells him, no, there's no place for you in my what? In my house. Okay? Tunstall in the summer of 1523 was occupied in Parliament, the first for 8 years. Though he snubbed Tyndall, it is observable that he did not persecute him. Tyndall stayed in London for almost a year. Fox records his preaching at St. Dunstan's in the West in Fleet Street. His sermons have not survived. St. Dunstan's apparently had connections with the growing reform movement, with the Ponitz family, with merchants in the cloth trade, particularly Murphy Monmouth, who took Tyndall into his house where he studied most part of the day and of the night, and at his book. Tyndall, by now realizing that to translate the New Testament there was no place in all of England, left for Germany probably in April 1524. The London merchants who supported him at his time at this time included Monmouth, who was therefore in serious trouble in May 1528. So 1524, by 1524 he realizes that he is not going to be able to translate the Bible where?
London.
In London, right? So by 1524 he leaves for where?
Germany.
Now, what's already happened previous to this that we studied last week? Has Luther already printed his first edition of the New Testament in September 1522?
Yes.
So, does he view Germany as a more safe or opportune place to be able to do this as a result? Okay? Well, fortunately for Tyndall, the devoutly Catholic Henry VIII had occupied the throne of England since 1509. In 1520 or 21, depending on the source, Henry, or someone from his court, probably Sir Thomas More, wrote a stinging tract attacking Luther's ideas. In recognition of Henry's support, the Pope gave him the title Defender of the Faith. Now, see, this is all just too funny, right? Because later on, is Henry going to have a beef with the Pope and break away from the Roman Catholic Church because the Pope is not going to grant him an annulment of his marriage, right? So, early on, Henry is extremely anti-Reformation, anti-Luther, anti all this stuff. And so as a result, he gets this this famous prize that's awarded to one person by the Pope every year, the title of Defender of the Faith. Okay? As noted above, following the Catholic Party line, Bishop Tunstall refused to let him translate, that'd be Tyndall, obviously, refused to let him translate the Greek New Testament into simple English. Quote, Tyndall realized it would be impossible to translate the Bible into English. It had been more than a century since the enactment of the constitutions at Oxford in 1408 forbade the reading of any non-approved English Bible. Neither Bishop Tunstall nor Cardinal Wolsey made any attempt to authorize the reading or translating of any Bible other than Latin. The bishops were unrelenting in their attempts to enforce the constitutions. Tyndall had two choices. He could remain in London and wait for better days, or leave his beloved England and translate elsewhere. His enthusiasm and burden to see even the plowboy have the scriptures in his language dictated against postponement. The only option was to set sail for Germany. After all, Germany was a hotbed of Reformation, should say of the Reformation, and there he could find sympathizers and proceed, unhindered at his work. So, 1524 he leaves for where?
Germany.
The reason he does that is because he perceives that he's not going to get anywhere. The church officials in England are backing the constitutions of 1408. Remember, those are the same church action that outlawed the Wycliffe Bible. Okay? So they are not budging on any of this stuff. And so Tyndall feels that if he's going to do this, he could either sit there and wait it out and hope the situation improved, which maybe it would have, maybe it wouldn't have, right? Or he can take action and leave England and go to Germany, where he's going to then work on this. Okay? All right, any questions before we go any further here? All right, 1524. In response, Tyndall fled to the Lutheran provinces in Germany, where he could work on his translation without interference. Tyndall arrived in Hamburg, Germany, in the midst of Luther's Reformation in May 1524. People were even reading the Bible in the German language, followed by theological discussion of the current issues of the day. What a contrast to Tyndall's England. So does he find a totally different set of circumstances when he arrives in Germany? He finds the open reading of the Bible in German and discussion thereof openly in a way that was not allowed in England. Okay? Bible collector and historian Donald L. Brake reports the following regarding any potential relationship between Luther and Tyndall. He says, quote, "Some zealous scholars, fearful that Tyndall may have leaned too heavily on Luther, deny that Tyndall ever met him. However, little question remains among most scholars that Tyndall did visit Luther in Wittenberg. It was while living in Wittenberg, where the university provided all the necessary tools, that Tyndall translated all or most of the New Testament. Tyndall certainly consulted the New Testament Luther had translated into German. It does not follow, however, that Tyndall's New Testament was an English translation of Luther's German New Testament. Tyndall was probably more competent in Greek and Hebrew than Luther, and his German was limited." So, in my mind, and I'm going to show you this in a future lesson, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that Tyndall knew Luther and was influenced by him. That does not mean, though, that what Tyndall did is he took a German Bible and translated a German Bible into English. Okay? That did not happen. Now, he probably looked at Luther's Bible. Luther's Bible may have influenced him to some degree, but his Bible is not a translation of Luther's German Bible as a sort of only source, right? He's going to be using a lot of different sources, including Erasmus. Everybody with that?
Yeah.
1525. In August 1525, Tyndall settled in the German city of Cologne. Did I say that?
Yeah,
Cologne. With his new assistant, William Roy. With the translation of the New Testament into English now complete, the new task was to ensure its printing and distribution. They chose to produce the work at the printing house of Peter Quantel. Okay? So this is now 1525. He's now in Cologne. C-O-L-G-N-E. And he is going to begin the process of what?
Printing.
He gets to Germany in 1524. He translates it at Wittenberg. He moves to Cologne to find a printer in 1525. And he's going to settle on Peter Quantel. Okay? However, Quantel's presses were also producing the works of Johannes Cochlaeus, a noted opponent of Luther. Okay, so understand. On this guy's press, is he also printing stuff anti-Luther?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? A noted opponent of Luther who happened to learn of Tyndall's project. It seems that some of Quantel's printers became drunk in a public tavern one evening and let slip that there were thousands of Lutheran New Testaments being produced in English right under the noses of the Catholic authorities. Word of this soon reached Cochlaeus, who was no fool, and could see his star rising in the German Catholic firmament if he were to oppose and block this project. He arranged for a raid on Quantel's presses. Tyndall and Roy, however, managed to escape and salvage at least some of their printing, along with the text of the translation. Undeterred, they moved their printing operation further up the Rhine into the city of Worms and began the tedious process all over again using the presses of Peter Schoeffer, is how I would say that. Okay? So, is there an attempt to print made in 1525? Yes. Is the attempt thwarted by the Catholic authorities? It is uncovered, it is made known, and they attack the press and shut it down. Tyndall and his friend Roy, they escape with the translation and some of the printed pages from that particular printing, and they move up to the city of Worms, where they're going to try again. Okay? Now, this gets very interesting. Not only did Cochlaeus have Quantel's presses shut down, he also, according to Condit, notified King Henry VIII of Tyndall's clandestine activities. Quote, Cochlaeus took immediate steps to inform the public authorities, and through an order from the Senate and through an order from the Senate to the press was stopped. He likewise, by letters, warned Henry VIII and his counselors and directed them to give order to every seaport to prevent the introduction of the baneful merchandise. Anticipating any further action of the Senate, Tyndall hastens to the printers, securing his manuscripts and pages already printed, escapes the net of Fowler by fleeing the city. We next hear of Tyndall at Worms, where without further opposition, he succeeds in his long cherished design. So, Cochlaeus not only shuts the press down, but does he send word back to England about what Tyndall's doing?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. It was long believed that the original... It was long believed that all the original printed text in Cologne had been lost. However, in 1834, 8 of these original sheets were discovered bound together in another work. Okay? These sheets help us to gauge the influence of Luther upon Tyndall's work. Okay? Now, I have from the internet, put this here where it says this is a facsimile. It says facsimile attests the printed English, the first printed English New Testament, William Tyndall, 1525. Okay? These sheets were discovered, as it said there in the notes, they were discovered in 1834, and they were printed in this edition. It says facsimile texts, the first New Testament printed, right, by William Tyndall. And this thing is published and edited by a guy named Abner, and this is done in 1871, where this is actually printed in an edition, right? And what they did is they reproduced these eight leaves, or these roughly 34 pages that were found bound into the other work, okay? Now, I didn't print all of it, but here is the beginning of Tyndall's prologue. So this is the prologue to the 1525 edition that was shut down at what? Cologne. Okay? So there's the prologue. You can see the prologue to it. You can see he's got a table of contents here of the books of the New Testament. And then you can also see, this is what I printed here. This is the sort of the artwork on the front page to the New Testament. Some sort of a Dictation of the Scriptures image here, it looks like, in the woodcut. And then you have the text here of the Gospels. So this is the Gospel of Matthew. This is in English. This would be the main text. And then you'll see in the margin, does he have marginal notes? Tyndall has marginal notes in his original 1525, right? Here's the second page of the Gospel of Matthew, and you can see more marginal notes here on the side, right? So, the reason why this is important is because it demonstrates the influence that Luther had on this 1525 Cologne edition that was shut down by the authorities. So go back to your notes, page 7. It has long been believed that, oh, I already said that, okay, blah, 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 blah. These sheets help us to gauge the influence of Luther upon Tyndall's work. The pages include a prologue. I just showed you that, okay? Which is dependent at points upon Luther's own prologue in his 1522 German New Testament. This was not included in the 1526 printing of Tyndall's work. Okay? The list of contents of the New Testament, I just showed you that, follows a conviction that existed within Lutheran circles at this stage, which regarded four New Testament books, Hebrews, James, Jude, as revelation, as being of dubious authenticity, right? So look at this again up here, if you would, please. So again, this is the prologue, right? And then if you look at the table of contents, you'll see that at the very bottom, he's got James, Hebrews, Jude, and Revelation set in small print at the bottom of the page, unnumbered in the table of contents. Okay? Who else did that?
Luther.
Okay? So was Luther clearly impacting and influencing what Tyndale was choosing to do in 1525? Okay? They were placed at the end of the contents and not numbered. I just showed you that. Tyndale appears to have been obligated to follow the conviction by Peter Quantel himself. The 1526 printing abandoned this conviction. The 1525 printing included marginal notes. The pages that have survived included 90 such notes. I just showed you that as well. Suggesting that Tyndale envisioned a high level of comment on the text throughout the New Testament. The general style and tone of these notes is Lutheran. Some are cribs of Luther's own notes. There are no such notes in the 1526 edition. Now I'm going to show you this now. We're not quite there in the... But this is a facsimile reprint of a 1526 Tyndale New Testament. Okay? So, there's some front stuff in here written by Daniel talking about it, but I want to go to this. This is what it showed up as. All it says is the New Testament with the date, 1526. There's no name, there's no title, there's no nothing. If you go to the next page, you just have the text of Matthew without any marginal what?
Notes.
Anything that's written in the margin in this was put there by the person that owned this Bible originally. Okay? There are no marginal notes, and all you have is a small text that is stripped down of the prologue, the table of contents, and all the marginal notes are taken out of what was actually printed in 1526. Okay? Now, I believe there's a reason for that. Has Cochlaeus sent word back to Henry VIII of what to be on the lookout for?
Yeah.
Yes. So what does Tyndale do?
Changes it.
He changes and alters the size and scope of the project to make it smaller, to remove his name, to remove a prologue, to remove a table of contents, to remove all the marginal notes, and simply give the English people the text in English in the 1526 New Testament. Okay. Given that Tyndale's actions were made known to the English authorities, many Bible historians believe that this prompted Tyndale to alter the size and contents of his Bible. The explanation seems to be that while Tyndale intended the Quattro edition, so that would have been the bigger one, okay? That would have been this one that I showed you earlier, that had the prologue and the table of contents and the marginal notes. This would have been the Quattro edition, okay? That's just talking about the size of the book. In printer language, the intended Quattro edition should be the first printed, so that the work was actually begun at Cologne, yet because it was interrupted and the English authorities were instructed particularly as to the character of the book issuing from the press at Cologne, he changed the form to an octavo, leaving out the prologue and glosses. So the evidence is very clear that he, in an effort to circumvent the knowledge that the church authorities in England had of the edition, that he purposefully altered it, condensed it into a smaller size so that it could escape detection as these things are brought into England. Okay? Remember, every single one of these 1526 New Testaments that made its way into England was every single one of them illegal.
Yes.
Okay? Altering the project may have given Tyndale's Bible a fighting chance of surviving introduction into England. A dated letter, March 1526, from King Henry VIII to Martin Luther, reveals that the English king had knowledge of Tyndale's clandestine project. It says, quote, and this is hard to read because this is all Old English, okay? Induced with one or two lewd persons, referring to Tyndale and Roy, born in our realm for the translating of the New Testament in English, as well as with many corruptions of the Holy Text, as certain prefaces and other pestilent glosses in the margins for the advancement of setting forth of his abominable heresies in the... I don't know what that word is. Okay.
I looked it up, I couldn't find it.
whereof we are of special tender zeal determined the said venture translations to be what? Burned with further sharp correction and punishment against the keepers and readers of the same. Now, let me tell you what all that means. Is the king fully aware that the first Bible that had been attempted at Cologne had marginal glosses and notes in it?
Yeah, so.
Yes. Yeah. He says to Luther, you've got two Englishmen living over there. They're basically heretics, and they're trying to propagate this text upon the English-speaking people. We're going to kill and burn anybody who is found having these what?
Books.
I think the evidence is very clear then that Tyndale shifted from a quattro to an octavo, and he purposely removed all the extra stuff, and all he gave the English-speaking people was the text of the New Testament. Nothing else did he give them in his 1526 New Testament. So we're almost done. The first printed New Testament in the English language was completed at Worms in 1526 in a small octavo edition. David Daniel chronicles how the 1526 Worms New Testament differed from the one Tyndale attempted to produce in Cologne the year before. He says, quote, Tyndale and Roy arrived probably late in 1525 in the safe Lutheran city of Worms, and the small printer, Peter Schaefer, undertook the English New Testament, the first ever made, completed in 1526. This is very different from the Lutheran Cologne fragment. It was octavo, pocket size. Now, you can see that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can see that the original size of the page is what's in this darker color here, right? He made it small on purpose so that it could be what? Hidden away, stashed, you know, put somewhere out of sight and hopefully avoid being detected. Okay? This is very different from the Lutheran Cologne fragment. It was octavo size, pocket size, like all Luther's books printed in his, like all Tyndale's books printed in his lifetime, and without prologue or marginal notes or attribution to him. This bare text had impact enough. Smuggled down the Rhine and into English and Scottish ports in bales of cloth, copies circulated quickly. For the first time, the whole New Testament, faithfully translated from the Greek, could be read by anyone. That this immediately alarmed the English authorities is amply testified. So, in our next lesson, we're going to pick up the story of the first printed English Bible and the circumstances surrounding its arrival, sale, distribution, and attempted destruction in England. Okay? That's a lot of history there. But I think it definitely gives you a good flavor and a good point, right? One of the reasons why I spent time on going through Luther last Sunday and looking at his 1522 New Testament, or September Testament, is because Tyndale initially endeavoring to do something very similar to what Luther did. So there's no doubt in my mind that Luther's work influenced the scope of the original project. That project was shut down. News of it was made known in England. King Henry VIII writes a letter to Luther complaining about it and threatening to burn any of these Bibles and anybody possessing them. So as a tactical move, what Tyndale does is he strips the project of anything unnecessary, reduces its size, and prints small pocket-sized New Testaments that can be easily smuggled in to England. Okay? So, does anybody have any questions or comments about any of that at this point?
Found it interesting last week how Luther perhaps he shows more interest in the epistles of Paul and the Romans especially.
Yep.
And the Gospel of John as well. It seemed like an interesting note for Luther.
I've had a couple people this week contact me and point out that they felt similar, that they were very much interested by the same observation that you're mentioning right now, that he would say stuff like that. That's the thing. The Luther's Reformation, in my mind, was Pauline Resurgence 1.0. Pauline Resurgence 2.0 came in the 1800s with the resurgence of dispensational truth and understanding that happened in England. It started first by Darby and then picked up on by people after him. So whether you're talking Reformation 1.0, the recovery or the resurgence of the issue of justification by faith alone, by grace alone, through Christ alone, that is fundamentally a Pauline thing. As is the resurgence of dispensational truth that occurs later on. And I'm saying it that way on purpose, right? In the Grace History Project, I try to show how Pauline truth was first willfully abandoned. Okay? It wasn't lost, because was it in here the whole time? Yeah. So it was willfully abandoned, and then it experienced a systematic resurgence that happened over a period of time, as people actually then had the Bible that they could read, that they could study, and as they read it and they studied it, did they gain more and more light and understanding in successive generations. And that's fundamentally what happened. So, yeah. Any other questions or comments about Tyndale? I personally have to say that I find all this fascinating about the first edition, and I find it even more interesting that stuff like this can still be found and accessed, you know, in places so that you can actually see, read, and understand what was actually going on. Okay? If there are no questions, we'll be done. So next Sunday, I should say, next Sunday we will have class, but Jason Brzezinski is going to be teaching the adult class. He asked if he could teach a lesson. So he will be teaching a lesson the first Sunday of the new year during this time frame, and then we will pick up with Tyndale here the second Sunday in January. Okay? All right, thanks for your attention.